I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The book has been described as a necessary read, and as to its subject, that's clear. Having just started it in recent days, I can attest that it is also a highly readable, clever, and engaging read. The book is called The Inconvenient Indian, A Curious Account of Native People in North America. Its author, Thomas King, joins me on the line today. In the book, he looks at the history of Native peoples on both sides of the border. He looks at the relationship with non-Natives, articulating the complexities and challenges that have confronted people, governments, and culture in the past that we currently face, and perhaps how those could be resolved in the future. The book is often funny, but it's also a frank conversation about the conversations that ought to happen. Thomas King outlines the context within which greater understanding could happen, points out myths that should be debunked, as well as poses strong challenges to ideas held longstanding and otherwise. Thomas King is one of Canada's premier Native intellectuals. He's a professor of English at the University of Guelph. He taught Native American studies at the University of Lethbridge and the University of Minnesota. He was the first Aboriginal person to deliver a Massey lecture, and he's previously written 7 books, including 5 novels and 2 short story collections. He was a creator of the CBC radio series The Dead Dog Cafe Comedy Hour. This book is published by Doubleday. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Vancouver this day, Thomas King. Professor King, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, I'm in the middle of the book, and I'm enjoying it because it's a great read. It has a sort of a conversational tone. I mean, it's a history book, but it's not really history, right?
Well, it is history, but I suppose the conversational tone helps to mask that fact.
Yeah, and you find that it's more effective, I guess, satire and humor better than, say, Fire and Brimstone?
Yeah, I do, because I did the Fire and Brimstone when I was sort of frontline activist years ago in the late 60s, early 70s. And while I'm sure I was entertaining in those days, I don't know that I was very effective at conveying ideas and changing people's minds. And so over the years, I discovered that a little bit of humor goes a long way.
Yeah. Now, the first part of the book, the first chapter, I suppose, if you could call it that, you spend that talking about the terms that you'll use.
Yes.
And it's important, I guess, what we call people. I mean, we're not supposed to really stereotype people or label them, but I mean, in this context, in this conversation that you're having in the book, you need to, right?
Well, I just wanted to sort of set those out so that people knew that I was making decisions on that I just wasn't doing it willy-nilly. And there are a number of terms.
The terms that you use in the book, and
right.
I guess it's also instructive in that you give us a sort of the etymology of what Aboriginal people, what Native people have been called. I mean, they've been called everything from Indian, Redskins, and the sort, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Amerindians, Native people, First Nations, First People. There are a lot of terms, and they're all, for the most part, they're all, you know, okay terms. I decided to, I mean, I use them all in the book.
Yeah.
But my default remains Indian, and I know that causes problems for some people, and you know I'm sorry that it does, but I still think it's the North American default.
Yeah, and political correctness, I guess, it's affected the sort of conversations that we should be having.
Yeah, I guess it's that's a hard term. That's a hard term to define. I mean, they use political correctness for all sorts of nonsense, and I don't know. I don't like using that term. I don't mind using Indians, but political correctness I stay away from.
Yeah. Now, the title of the book, can we sort of break that down? The Inconvenient Indian.
Yes.
Refers to who, and where are they found, and who finds Indians inconvenient?
Oh, well, I mean, I think North America finds Indians inconvenient, period, especially those Indians that still control a land base of some sort. In the book, I break Indians down for the purposes of the discussion to dead Indians, live Indians, and legal Indians. And in terms of the land base that Native people have, it's legal Indians that you'd be talking about there.
Mm-hmm. In the course of writing the book, did you have an audience in mind? Like, did you want certain people to read this book?
Yeah, I guess over the years, as I've taught Native history and as I've lectured around North America and elsewhere for that matter, people ask me pretty much the same questions. And so this book in part was aimed at not so much answering those questions, but certainly setting out some terms of engagement for those questions. I can provide answers, but I prefer that, you know, people look at the information, the evidence, and the historical material and make up their own minds. But my audience was a sort of a general audience, both Native and non-Native.
Yeah. And what do you want us to learn about the Indian experience?
Well, I don't know that the book itself is going to teach you as much as I'd like North America to learn, but I think it begins a conversation. I think the book, when I wrote the book, I looked at the arcs, the historical arcs that have occurred in Native, non-Native history. And I wanted to lay those out as a general blueprint. And I think that maybe someone will, you know, read the book and be interested in, you know, a couple of aspects of that history and go off and do their own research, their own reading on that. So I suppose at best, the book might be an encouragement.
Yeah, you dispel some myths in the book.
Try to.
Yeah. I guess let's start at the cover. This is a poster I read for a tourism poster, and it hangs in your house, is that right?
Yeah, quite a few years ago I was at an art show, and there was a table full of original posters.
Yeah.
And there was this one poster that caught my eye, and it was a poster for an Italian cruise line, and they were advertised. This poster was advertising trips to North America, and it had this great gleaming ship bursting out of the emerald waves, and in the foreground was this stereotypical sort of crimson outline of an Indian full headdress peeking out of the ship past the palm fronds. And this was way, evidently, Europeans saw North America as, you know, sort of an Indian behind every bush in the 1930s and 1940s.
Mm-hmm. And then where do you think, I mean, history gets whitewashed, I suppose, but this idea that natives were savages, that they committed horrendous massacres and the sort, those myths and that sort of history and how it's been built into the history, is there someone responsible for that?
Well, certainly, you know, North America itself is responsible for it. Whenever you meet a new people, I mean, the natural tendency is to try to describe your civilization, what you believe in, and how, you know, and how you do things as being better than someone else's. This is just sort of a natural knee-jerk kind of thing. And so North Americans, or Europeans, when they came to North America, saw their culture as the culture, and everything else is below that. And so when they came to North America and they saw Native people, they weren't much interested in knowing or understanding what Native people did or what they thought. More interested in just making sure that they were the default.
Now there are, of course, great challenges to Native people in this country, at least, and elsewhere. But a real pressing problem is the perception in popular culture, right?
Well, that's one of the problems. The big problem is land, but certainly popular culture.
Well, we'll talk about land in a minute. Yep, but yep. I'm interested in how natives are perceived in or depicted, I should say, in popular culture, and what do you think needs to change there?
Well, I mean, Native people are North America's antiquity. North America doesn't have Greeks and Romans or Incas and Aztecs and whatnot that other parts of the world may have. We sort of are it. And North America would prefer that the Indian that it deals with is that stereotypical Indian because, for one, that Indian is dead. And he cuts a very fine figure in the imagination of North America. America, and, you know, we can use them in advertising. I think it was, oh, one of the lingerie companies, Victoria's Secret,
mm-hmm.
that had one of their models on the runway in, you know, those lovely, skimpy lingerie pieces, and she was wearing a full feather headdress all the way down to the floor. And you sort of say, you know, why would they do that? But the fact of the matter is that that particular image is so prevalent in North America that we can hardly get around it. Every cowboy and Indian movie ever made has somebody in a full feather headdress with beads and leathers and pinto ponies chasing buffalo, et cetera, et cetera. Those things are so stuck in the North American imagination, it's almost impossible to get them out.
Is how non-natives view natives, is that affecting how natives perceive themselves?
Well, sure. I mean, if you look at the television and movies, I mean, native people watch that just like non-natives do, and you can't help but be affected by the stereotypes and the cliches that exist there. That's nothing new. I mean, we've been talking about that for years, and
mm-hmm.
And while it's changed somewhat, it hasn't changed all that much. You would have expected it would change a lot more.
Now, you mentioned earlier, I mean, the foremost concern in solving a lot of the problems is dealing with land claims, settling land claims. I guess education, that's also important. But in this country, sort of the settlement of land claims comes up, there's a lot of people, there's a number of people, I should say, who say, well, this is, they view it as a sort of a grab bag of gifts or handouts. And that really belies the sort of context that you feel that we don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is true that many North Americans, many Canadians, don't understand that treaties were not sort of gifts that you got, loot bags at a movie gala, that the government didn't just one day pick up and say, you know what, we should give our native people a whole bunch of stuff that they haven't had before.
Mm-hmm.
The fact of the matter is that when natives and non-natives were not getting along all that well and fighting, both sides decided, you know what, this is crazy and very costly. Why don't we just agree not to do this anymore, and we'll sort of divvy up the land here and there. So we signed treaties.
Mm-hmm.
And when Native people signed treaties, they gave up a large part of their land base in exchange for ownership of the other part of the land base. And they also negotiated rights with the Canadian government, with the U.S. government. And over the years, the Canadian and U.S. government has forced many tribes to renegotiate those treaties and give up more land in exchange for keeping the land that they have. And so this land base has been dwindling. And so non-native governments haven't given native people anything. We've negotiated and paid for those rights and paid for that land base sometimes two and three and four times. So that particular myth, which is still prevalent within the society, is one that I'd really like to get rid of, because it really is fallacious.
And then you get sort of people who are opposed to settling land claims, you get that argument. I'm sure you read it in op-eds and the sort that.
The
why can't you people just get over what happened in the past and move on?
Yeah, and the answer is because we've got a contract with the governments of the U.S. and Canada, and there's no reason why we should give up that land base. No reason why we should give up those rights. You know, we paid for them. If you'd gotten involved in a contractual arrangement with somebody and they came along and said, you know what, even though this is a contract between the two of us, I'm going to unilaterally cancel it and, just tough luck, you'd be fairly aggrieved, and you'd probably want to take it to court and get that settled, because that's just not the way to do business.
And the role that natives are playing nowadays in this province, you see this, with regards to environmental issues,
mm-hmm.
That's key as well, right? That's an important part of the debate that often gets forgotten.
Well, certainly the environment is a huge debate, and I know that many of the bands are at the forefront of that, particularly right now with the pipelines
mm-hmm.
that various companies want to push right through. really no regard to what might happen. I mean, much of the technology that the oil companies are using right now are everything from fracking to stacking up sulfur blocks on the prairies just because they don't know what to do with those blocks. I mean, they have no idea what's happening, but they do know that they want to make a profit, and it's profit at all costs. It's sort of a crazy situation. And Native people, in some ways, are there to say, you know, well, okay, but not on our land and not on our backs.
Have you seen a sort of change in how, I guess, the relations are between Natives and non-Natives in recent years? Like, did the apology from the federal government in 2008, did that accomplish much?
Just me personally, no.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I mean, I think the Prime Minister was sincere in offering the apology, but about 2 or 3 months after he offered the apology, he was down at the G20 summit in Philadelphia, where he announced that Canada did not have a history of colonization. I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
there's sort of a disconnect there when the man can say, you know, on behalf of the Canadian government, we're sorry, and on the other hand, saying, you know, we had nothing to do with that.
Right. And do you think that there could be greater change, do you think? I mean, are you hopeful?
I'm always hopeful. I tend to be a pessimist, but I wake up every morning and begin to write hoping that things are going to get better.
Yeah, and so the relationship between Natives and non-Natives, that's not irreparable, right?
It's not irreparable, but we've spent, you know, some 400 years developing that relationship on a bad line, and it's not going to be repaired overnight. It's not going to be repaired within one generation. I think that's what non-Natives really want to see happen, is for Native people to say, okay, it's okay. You know, don't worry about it. It's all right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not going to happen. It's going to take years, and a lot of the first steps, and maybe the second and third steps, are going to have to come from non-Natives.
But what do you think the part Natives should play, though, in the debate, or in what change needs to happen?
Well, they should be part of the debate. I mean, right now we're not. You know, governments come onto Native land with their minds made up what's going to happen, and they don't even talk to us sometimes. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that the federal government stepped in and leased Musqueam land without even letting the Musqueam know that they had done it or what the terms of the agreement were. You know, that's in, I want to say, this century. It's actually technically in the last century, but it's within my lifetime.
Yeah. Is there a problem, though, with regards to because there are all sorts of bands, or a number of bands, I should say, there are different nations.
Yep.
The Native voice, that is there one cohesive voice, do you think? I mean,
no.
You certainly, in this book, you could be considered one voice, right?
You mean my voice?
Yeah, speaking for, you know, certain groups, say.
Oh, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I've got one voice, and I certainly am... I'm looking at the stories of various other people, but I would never put myself in a position where I was speaking for other groups, other bands, other tribes. I'm sort of, think of me as a floating Indian.
Huh.
You know, I'm looking at it from a distance. You know, I've got no business telling any of the bands, any of the tribes, what they should do. I'm just laying this out so people can see it, and so that they have an idea of what the patterns are.
Is there the relationship between Natives on reserve and those off reserve? Is there something to reconcile there?
Well, I mean, it's certainly there's some disconnect there, but the real disconnect is between legal Indians and or between status Indians and non-status Indians. Status Indians in Canada, this is not the U.S., but in Canada, status Indians are those Indians that have Native rights, that have land, have a land base. Non-status Indians do not. And it would be nice if Native people themselves, status and non-status, could get into a conversation about, you know, the way forward for Native people as a group. But I don't know if that's going to happen. It'd be nice if it did.
Yeah. Now, in the book, I understand you talk about Christy Blatchford in her book about Caledonia.
Just a mention.
Yeah, but I guess that's symptomatic of how people in the media frame the debate. And then she was on this program to talk when that book came out.
Yeah.
I understand you share the same publisher. That she only wanted to talk about what happened there.
Yes.
At that time.
Yeah.
And she didn't want to talk about land claims. She didn't want to talk about the history.
Right.
But you think that that's important, that needs to be discussed. And as I said, it's symptomatic of, say, how the media frames issues in the press and in her case, in this book, and in her column writing.
Well, I mean, if you talked about World War II and didn't mention the two atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you would have some problems with that, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
And what Blatchford does basically is simply say, okay, look, I'm not gonna take on or talk about any of the history that led up to this moment, that created this moment. I'm just gonna look at the moment itself. I find that rather short-sighted and myopic.
Yeah, and do you think there can be change in, say, how issues are covered in the press?
Oh, how they're covered. Well, I guess the press has their own way of covering issues. Certainly the old, if it bleeds, it leads, is, I think, still very much a press axiom. Sure, there could be, but much of the time I don't find the stories that get covered in the press to be very detailed. There's only so much room in a column for it or in a story, and what you get are just the I don't want to call them high points, but okay, I suppose that's what they are. And not much else, not much background. When you're talking about Native issues, and when you're talking about protests in particular, you know, unless you're willing to look at the history, you're not going to understand the situation.
And you're on a book tour promoting this book, traveling to various cities in the country. How has the book been received thus far? I know it's early days, but...
So far, I've been really quite flabbergasted by it. We were in Winnipeg, and I figured I'd get maybe, 30, 40, 50 people at the bookstore that night, and we wound up with 140 and sold I don't know how many books, and went over to Victoria to First People's House over there on the U of Vic campus, and we expected probably to get about, 50, 75 people. We got over 400. So, and I'm I'll be up at UBC. So I don't know. So far, it's been great.
Yeah, it's a great book, and I'm finding it informative, and I'm enjoying it. Continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
The book is called The Inconvenient Indian, A Curious Account of Native People in North America. It's published by Doubleday. Its author, Thomas King, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.